Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. What we have been doing for some months now is exploring the myths about money. Our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. We've been specifically looking at a book called The Web of Debt, which unravels the deception and presents a clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading. It then explores workable alternatives, particularly one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. It helps us to analyze and improve our own financial security, personally and nationally, and to deeply understand the cause of the problems we are personally experiencing financially. At the onset, I give an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles on debt-related matters. I highly recommend her book, The Web of Debt. You should also visit her website by the same name. You could also go to www.kruufm.com under Archives to listen to all of the shows produced on this and other debt-related topics. This particular series is under Life and Debt Web. In the last show, I ended talking about derivatives, like a class, Derivatives 101. We're looking at a website of Gary Novak, the website that simplifies complex issues, and he explains that the banking system has become gridlocked because its pretended derivative assets are fake, and the fake assets have swallowed up the real assets. It all began with deregulation in the 1980s, when government regulation was considered an irrational scheme from which business had to be freed. But regulations are criminal codes, and eliminating them meant turning business over to thieves. The Enron and WorldCom defendants were able to argue in court that their procedures were legal because the laws making them illegal had been wiped off the books. Government regulation prevented the creation of funny money without real value. When regulations were eliminated, funny money became the order of the day. It manifested in a variety of very complex vehicles lumped together under the label of derivatives, which were often made intentionally obscure and confusing. Physicists were hired to write equations for derivatives which business administrators could not understand, according to Novak. Derivatives are just bets, but they have been sold as if they were something of value until the sales have reached astronomical sums that are far beyond anything of real value in existence. Pension funds and trust funds have bought into this Ponzi scheme only to see their money disappear down the derivatives hole. Universities have been forced to charge huge tuitions, although they are financed with huge trust funds, because their money has been tied up in investments that are basically worthless. But the administrators are holding onto their bets, which are given a pretended value because heads roll when the truth comes to light. Nobody dares to sell and nobody can collect. The result is a shortage of available funds in global financial institutions. The very thing derivatives were designed to create, market liquidity, has been frozen to immobility in a gridlocked game. The author of a blog called World Vision Portal simplifies the derivatives problem in another way. He writes, quote, "Anyone who has been to Las Vegas or at a casino on a cruise ship can understand it perfectly. A bank gambles and bets on certain predetermined odds, like playing the casino dealer in a game of poker. Banks call this hedging their risks with derivative contracts. When they have to show their cards at the end of the play, they either win or lose their bet. Either the bank wins or the house wins. This is the end of the derivative contract term. For us small-time players, we might lose $10 or $20, but the big-time banks are betting hundreds of millions of dollars on each card hand. The worst part is that they have a gambling addiction and can't stop betting money that isn't theirs to bet with. Winners always leave the gambling table with a big smile, and you can see the chips in their hands to know they won more than they had bet. But losers always walk away quietly and don't talk about how much they lost. If a bank makes a good profit, won their bet, they would be telling everyone that their derivative contracts have paid off and they're sitting pretty. In reality, big-time gambling banks are not talking and won't tell anyone how much they gambled or how much they lost. We've been hoodwinked and the game is pretty much over." End quote. The true irony is that derivative bets are sold as a form of insurance against something catastrophic going wrong. But if something catastrophic does go wrong, the counterparties, the parties on the other side of the bet, typically hedge funds, are liable to fold their cards and drop out of the game. The insured are left with losses both from the disaster itself and from the loss of the premium paid for the bet. To avoid that result, the Federal Reserve, along with other central banks, a fraternity of big private banks, and the U.S. Treasury itself, have gotten into the habit of covertly bailing out losing counterparties. This was done when the giant hedge fund Long-Term Capital Management went bankrupt in 1998, and it was also evidently done in 2005, but very quietly. Rumors of a derivatives crisis dwarfing even the LTCM debacle surfaced in May of 2005 following the downgrading of the debts of General Motors and Ford Motor Corporation to junk bonds having a credit rating below investment grade. Severe problems had apparently occurred at several large hedge funds directly linked to these downgradings. In May 2005 article, Luther Kampf wrote, quote, "The stocks of the same large banks that participated in the 1998 LTCM bailout, and which are known for their giant derivatives portfolios, including Citigroup, JPMorgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, and Deutsche Bank, were hit by panic selling on May 10th. Behind this panic was the knowledge that not only have these banks engaged in dangerous derivatives speculation on their own accounts, but ever desperate for cash to cover their own deteriorating positions, they also turned to the even more speculative hedge funds, placing money with existing funds or even setting up their own to engage in activities they didn't care to put on their own books. The combination of financial desperation, the Fed's liquidity binge, and the usury limiting effects of low interest rates triggered an explosion in the number of hedge funds in recent years as everyone chased higher and riskier returns. There can be no doubt that some of these banks, not only their hedge fund offspring, are in trouble right now. End quote. And I'll return in a moment. If you're just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from CRU LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now let's get back to derivatives. There were dire warnings which followed a derivatives crisis beyond the magnitude of the LTCM crisis, but reports of major derivative blowout were being publicly denied, says Kampf. Since any bank or hedge fund that admitted such losses without first working a bailout scheme would instantly collapse. An insider in the international banking community said that there is no doubt that the Fed and other central banks are pouring liquidity into the system covertly. This would not become public until early April 2006, at which point the Fed and other central banks will have to report on the money supply. We've seen that when the Fed pours liquidity into the system, it does it by open market operations that create money with accounting entries. This money is lent into the money supply, monetizing government debt. If it became widely known that the Fed were printing dollars wholesale, alarm bells would sound. Investors would rush to cash in their dollar holdings, crashing the dollar and the stock market, following the familiar pattern seen in the third world countries. Now, what to do? The Fed apparently chose to muffle the alarm bells. It announced that in March 2006, it would no longer be reporting M3. M3 has been the main staple of money supply measurement and transparent disclosure for the last half century, the figure on which the world relied in determining the soundness of the dollar. In December 2005, an article called The Grand Delusion, financial analyst Rob Kirby wrote, quote, "On March 23, 2006, the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System will cease publication of the M3 monetary aggregate. The board will also cease publishing the following components: large denomination time deposits, repurchase agreements, those are RPs, and euro dollars. These securities are exactly where one would expect to find the capture of any large-scale monetization effort that the Fed would embark upon should the need occur." End quote. And to this, a commentator going by the name of Captain Hook observed, quote, "This is as big a deal as Nixon closing the gold window back in 71, and we all know what happened after that. It almost looks like the boys are getting ready to unleash Weimar Republic II on the world. Can you say welcome to the People's Republic of the United States of what used to be America? We just got another very big signal from U.S. monetary authorities that the rules of the game are about to change fundamentally once again." End quote. When Nixon closed the gold window internationally in 1971, and when Roosevelt did it domestically before that, the rules were changed to keep a bankrupt private banking system afloat. And again, the emphasis is private banking system. The change in the Fed's reporting habits in 2006 appears to have been designed for the same purpose. The Fed was soon rumored to be madly printing up $2 trillion in new Federal Reserve notes. Why? Some analysts pointed to the festering derivatives crisis, while others said it was the housing crisis. But there were also rumors of a third cyclone on the horizon. Iran announced that it would be opening an oil market, or bourse, in euros in March 2006, sidestepping the 1974 agreement with OPEC to trade oil only in U.S. dollars. An article in the Arab online magazine Al Jazeera warned that the Iranian bourse could lead to a collapse in value for the American currency, potentially putting the U.S. economy in its greatest crisis since the Depression era of the 1930s. Rob Kirby wrote, quote, "If countries like Japan and China, and other Asian countries with their trillions of dollars, no longer need them or require a great deal less of them to buy oil, and begin wholesale liquidation of U.S. debt obligations, there is no doubt in my mind that the Fed will print the dollars necessary to redeem them. This would necessarily imply an absolutely enormous, can you say hyperinflation, bloating of the money supply, which would undoubtedly be captured statistically in M3 or its related reporting. It would appear that we're all going to be flying blind as to how much money the Fed is truly going to pump into this system." End quote. For the Federal Reserve to monetize the government's debt with newly issued dollars is actually nothing new. When no one else buys U.S. securities, the Fed routinely steps in and buys them with money created for the occasion. What is new, and what has analysts alarmed, is that the whole process is now occurring behind a heavy curtain of secrecy. Richard Dowdy, an entertaining commentator who writes in the Daily Reckoning as the Mogambu Guru, commented in 2006, quote, "There was a flurry of excitement last week when there was a rumor that the Federal Reserve had printed up, suddenly, $2 trillion in cash. My initial reaction was, of course, ha 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 ha. And my reasoning is thus, why would they go through the hassle? They can make electronic money with the wave of a finger, so why go through the messy rigmarole of dealing with ink and paper and all the problems of transporting it and counting it and storing it and blah blah blah. But this whole $2 trillion in cash scenario has some merit, especially if you are thinking that foreigners dumping American securities would instantly be reflected in the instantaneous losses in bonds and meteoric rises in interest rates, and the entire global economic machine would melt down. Bummer. So maybe this could explain that $2 trillion cash plan. With this amount of cash, see, the American government can pretty much buy all the government securities that any foreigners want to sell, but the inflationary effects of creating such money won't be felt in prices for a while. Ha ha ha. They think this is clever. End quote. It might be clever if it really were the American government buying back its own securities, but it isn't. It is the private Federal Reserve and private banks. If dollars are to be printed wholesale and federal securities are to be redeemed with them, why not let Congress do the job itself and avoid a massive unnecessary debt to financial middlemen? And this really is the nub of the whole problem, the private financial middlemen. Arguably, as we will see later, if the government were to buy back its own bonds and take them out of circulation, it could not only escape a massive federal debt, but could do this without producing inflation. Government securities are already traded around the world just as if they were money. They would just be turned into cash, leaving the overall money supply unchanged. When the Federal Reserve buys up government bonds with newly issued money, on the other hand, the bonds aren't taken out of circulation. Instead, they become the basis for generating many times their value in new loans, and that result is highly inflationary. But this is probably getting a little ahead of our story, which I will come back to in a moment. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. The Fed has succeeded in hiding its sleight of hand by concealing the numbers for M3, but inflation was obviously occurring. By the spring of 2006, oil, gold, silver, and other commodities were skyrocketing. Then, mysteriously, these inflation indicators too got suppressed. In the British journal Financial News Online in October of 2006, Barry Riley observed, quote, "Until the summer, the trends appeared ominous. The Fed was raising short rates and inflation was climbing. The price of crude oil stopped short of $80 a barrel. Sales of new homes were dropping off a cliff. Then, as if by magic, everything changed. The oil price went into reverse, tumbling to under $60 with favorable implications for the consumer price index measure of inflation. Similarly, the gold bullion price, an indicator of the potential fragility of the dollar exchange rate, had crashed from its early summer high. The Dow Jones average 2 weeks ago advanced to a high, at last beating the bubble top in January 2000. The pattern is curious. Perhaps bonds and commodities have been anticipating a recession. But then, why has the equity market climbed? Conspiracy theories have abounded since Hank Paulson's boss of Goldman Sachs was nominated in May to become Treasury Secretary. He had no political qualifications, but a powerful reputation as a market fixer. Was he brought in to shore up the financial and commodities market ahead of the November 2006 elections? End quote. The suspicion arose that the Fed and its banking partners were hiding bad economic news in another way, by actually manipulating markets. Catherine Austin Fitz, former Assistant Secretary of HUD, called it the Orwellian scenario. In a 2004 interview, she darkly observed, quote, "We've reached a point where, rather than let financial assets adjust, the powers that be now have such control of the economy through the banking system and through the governmental apparatus that they can simply steal more money, whether it's by keeping the stock market pumped up, the derivatives going, or the gold price manipulated down." In other words, you can adjust to your economy not by letting the value of the stock market or financial assets fall, but you can use warfare and organized crime to liquidate and steal whatever it is you need to keep the game going. And that's the kind of Orwellian scenario whereby you can basically keep this thing going, but in a way, that leads to a highly totalitarian government and economy, corporate feudalism. End quote. Latter-day Paul Revere warned that domestic security measures were being tightened and civil rights were being stripped. These developments mirrored IMF policies in third world countries, where the IMF riot was actually anticipated and factored in when austerity measures were imposed. Conspiracy theorists pointed to efforts to get the Constitution suspended under the Emergency Powers Act, martial law imposed under the Patriot and Homeland Security Acts, and the American democratic form of government replaced with the police state. They noted the use of the military in 2005 to quell rioting in New Orleans following Hurricane Katrina, in violation of Posse Comitatus, a statute forbidding U.S. active military participation in domestic law enforcement. They observed that fully armed private mercenaries, some of them foreign, even appeared on the streets. The scene recalled a statement made by former U.S. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger at a 1992 conference at the secretive Bilderbergers, covertly taped by a Swiss delegate in 1992. Kissinger reportedly said, quote, "Today, America would be outraged if UN troops entered Los Angeles to restore order. Tomorrow, they will be grateful. The one thing every man fears is the unknown. When presented with this scenario, individual rights will be willingly relinquished for the guarantee of their well-being granted to them by the world government." End quote. Suspicions were voiced concerning the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, which was in charge of disaster relief. In November of 2005, in a newsletter, Al Martin wrote, quote, FEMA is being upgraded as a federal agency, and upon passage of Patriot Act 3, which contains the amendment to overturn Posse Comitatus, FEMA will be remilitarized, which will give the agency military police powers. Why is all of this being done? Why is the regime moving to a militarized police state and to a dictatorship? It is because when the United States can no longer service its debt, it collapses as an economic entity. We would be an economically collapsed state. The only way government can function and can maintain control in an economically collapsed state is through military dictatorship. End quote. Critics charge that warfare, terrorism, and natural disasters on an unprecedented scale are being used to justify massive federal borrowing, while diverting attention from the fact that the economy is drowning in a sea of governmental and consumer debt. And that may be true, but policymakers are only doing what they have to do under the current monetary scheme. In an upside-down world in which debt is money and money is debt, somebody has to go into debt just to keep money in the system so the economy won't collapse. Old productive virtues, hard work, productivity, and creativity, have gone out the window. The new producers of the economic growth are borrowers and speculators. Henry C.K. Liu draws an analogy from physics. Quote, whenever credit is issued, money is created. The issuing of credit creates debt on the part of the counterparty, but debt is not money. Credit is. If anything, debt is negative money, a form of financial antimatter. Physicists understand the relationship between matter and antimatter. The collision of matter and antimatter produces annihilation that returns matter and antimatter to pure energy. The same is true with credit and debt, which are related but opposite. The collision of credit and debt will produce an annihilation and return the resultant union to pure financial energy unharnessed for human benefit. End quote. Credit and debt cancel each other out and merge back into the great zero-point field from whence they came. To avoid that result and keep money in the economy, new debt must continually be created. When commercial borrowers aren't creating enough money by borrowing it into existence, the government must take over that function by spending money it doesn't have, justifying its loans in any way it can. Keeping the economy alive means continually finding ways to pump newly created loan money into the system while canceling the fact that this money has been spun out of thin air. These new loans don't necessarily have to be paid back. New money just has to be circulated, providing a source of funds to pay the extra interest that wasn't lent into existence by the original loans. A variety of alternatives for pumping liquidity into the system have been resorted to by governments and central banks, and we will investigate into these 7 or 8 points in the next show. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.